True Digital Security CEO Rory Sanchez joins us this week to touch on a number of big news stories from Tech Data, Carbonite, Dell Technologies, and Cloud Oak, plus partnering with unconventional partners, Canna Businesses, Big Business, and much more. It's Channel Pro Weekly, episode 124, Pay Me in Blueberries. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Channel Pro Weekly, episode 124. My name is Matt Whitlock, technology editor, online director, and your host of this fine audio and video program where we talk about things that you care about. And who are you? Well, I'm going to introduce the man that's going to tell you who you are in case you're having an identity crisis. He is the man on the road, the one who makes jeans and sport coats look fashionable with the slicked back hair and glasses. You got a picture already. It's beautiful. Executive editor, Rich Freeman.
So, listeners, I know who you are. I'm not sure who I am. we'll work on that a little bit here. But, your value-added resellers, your MSPs, your cloud solution providers, your systems integrators, IoT integrators, you are the folks who are out there on the front line serving small and mid-sized businesses with technology services every day. And if that describes you, you are where you belong.
And a fantastic description it is. But Rich, I'm pleased to tell you and our wonderful listening audience that we are not alone today. We have a stalker in the room. No, it's not a stalker. It's someone who's going to chime in on the topics and join us as a special guest host today, the CEO of True Digital Security, Mr. Rory Sanchez.
That is correct. I am here stalking and while Rich told us who we are, or I guess who's listening, I'm still trying to figure out who we are. So thanks for the invite to the show as we all figure out who we are.
And it's awesome to have you here. We have had you on before, long ago. We were trying to figure that out kind of before we got started. But for those who have been longtime listeners, especially back before we even had video, Mr. Rory Sanchez joined us in episode 97 as well. So if you want to go back and take a listen to that one and hear a little bit more Rory Sanchez, please feel free. But Rory, I'm going to give you a chance for those who maybe unfamiliar with you or are new to the show to kind of give people an idea of who you are and what True Digital Security is and what you guys do.
Sure. So again, Rory Sanchez, I'm CEO of True Digital Security. I did not know that your show now had videos, so you know, excuse the attire.
Dude, that is like fashionable, like what IT people wear these days. Formal.
Exactly. I'm just trying to keep that image going. Is actually what it was.
You need a can of Mountain Dew Code Red next to you, and then like you'll
pull off. I just pulled off a little water, but I like it. Yeah, the Mountain Dew or what was the old Jolt Cola?
Yeah, Jolt.
That's where software was created originally, right next door to the Jolt Cola labs. But for the programmers who were up all night going, I know how to code it this time. And that's what kept them going. A little known fact. But who are we? So we are, our company is a cybersecurity managed IT managed security company. We have a big focus around compliance automation. We sort of put a couple companies together in the last couple of years. A company that had been in IT professional services and managed IT services since kind of the early days of the managed IT world for SMB. And then we combined it with a pure play cybersecurity company that had never sold or configured a single product. They were pure play security consulting, security program development, validation, testing. And what we found was that we had, not only did we have clients on either side who were looking for a more holistic solution, but we kind of had a vision of what we could do together. And that's what sort of led us to bring the companies together. And our niche nowadays, we've sort of become the tech companies for tech companies, it sort of speak, where we're working with, there's a lot of tech companies out there that are really super focused on delivering value to their clients with whatever technology they're bringing to the table. And we're kind of working with them behind the scenes to make sure that they stay safe and secure and compliant and out of the news these days for somehow being a conduit to a breach that affects maybe not just them, but also their clients.
And what a
great progressive business model. And we'll be talking about security today on the show and the giant opportunity. In fact, I mean, so just as backstory here, I bumped into Rory at the ConnectWise IT Nation event 2 weeks ago. And we just said, well, hey, it's been a while. We chatted in the hallway. And then I was kind of thinking about, well, who should we maybe invite onto the show the next episode we do as a guest host? And it occurred to me that I'm going to be where I am right now, which is in the Phoenix area at a security event hosted by Tech Data. And I thought, perfect. We'll bring on the security guy and catch up with him.
So when people go, how do I get on the podcast? The answer is you bump into Rich and you say, hi, don't really have time to talk. Let's catch up soon. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, here you are. So that's the secret sauce.
That's exactly it. I have a very, very short-term memory. So if you're the last person to have bumped into me, you're probably going to be on the next podcast.
Hey, you're spilling all of our trade secrets here, guys.
I apologize.
So, and what an honor to have you here, and great timing since we do have a lot of security related things to cover. So, as we go, I'm sure we're going to learn a little bit more about you and your expertise, but man, oh man, you are the right guest host to have on today. Let me just give everyone a quick little brief overview of what we're going to be talking about today. We've got several stories out of Tech Data that we're going to be talking about. We're going to take a tour of the Tech Data Cyber Range as well, which is going to be interesting. There's been another acquisition. We should just call this like the Who Buys Who podcast, because this seems like all we talk about these days. So we got actually two acquisition stories we're going to talk about. Dell is in the news. Cloud Oak has a story in here. And plus, we've got some other stories. We're going to talk about Canna Business, which apparently is big business, according to the headline, and partnering with unconventional partners. So this is where we're going to talk about welders and electricians and bakers and how you can bring them into your IT business. No, that is not what it is about at all.
Actually, that's exactly what it's about. But we'll come back to that.
We'll come back to that. Yeah, those are definitely unconventional partners. So you got to think outside the box and more in the oven as we go through here. Rich, we do normally have a museum and tech pick. I think with 8 big stories and a guest, we're going to run long, so we're probably going to skip that this week. But we'll have a museum pick and tech pick next week. But I could come up with a tech pick real quick if time does allow.
Okay.
Or of course, if Rory has like an old piece of gear that he's happened to hang on to, special IT or CE product that's special to you and it's nearby, I am more than happy to hand over the museum segment to Mr. Rory Sanchez.
I don't think I have anything nearby. I had an old plug-in ViewMaster projector recently, and I thought I think it's at this point dangerous to plug this thing in, so I gave it to someone who was more of a collector than I would be.
Is it like that scene in Christmas Vacation where they flip on the Christmas lights and like the whole nuclear station goes dark? You got to flip
exactly.
Yeah, I know those things. Well, for the next time you're on, if you do have something fun and interesting that you want to share, we are always happy to explore the things of other people. Now, Rory, in the background, I do see a guitar. Are you a guitarist?
I am a wannabe guitarist.
So what do you got back there?
What are we looking at? Oh, that's probably the first little free acoustical guitar that I got from someone. So that's actually probably a great story. I had a client many, many, many years ago when we were working with some very small companies, and these guys owed me what was a pile of money at the time. And someone told me that these guys were going out of business, cleaning out their offices, and if I expected to get anything out of them, I should show up immediately. And I actually drove down there, and what I found was a whole bunch of guitars still in a box. And I took one of them, and that was my very first guitar. And it's actually that one that's right there.
And what kind of guitar is that?
I believe it's an Alvarez. So it's just a little inexpensive acoustic guitar.
Awesome. Wow. Yeah. And you play, right? Like you've been learning.
I play a little bit. It's funny. A number of years ago, a couple of friends of mine and I, including some people who work for our company, were all. We had a couple of people who were pretty good musicians, and Heath, who was our director of tech services at the time, and I were. We decided to. We were both going to learn how to play guitar at the same time, and the first guitar lesson that came around, I didn't make it. He did. He went on to start a band. And I play about the same as I did, you know, 6 years ago. So I like guitars.
That is awesome.
I like guitars, and I'm a big fan of guitarists, but I would not call myself one.
Absolutely. I played bass for a while when I was younger and did vocals in a band. So but I'm probably so rusty, you and I could get together and we could call it the Rusty Sanchez's band.
There you go. It's having an award-winning name like that is a big key to the whole thing.
And Rich, you play the kazoo, correct?
Exactly.
And the triangle, I think you can handle that one, maybe.
No, I'm working
the triangle. We'll get you lessons.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're gonna dive into the news. But first, you know, before we do that, Rich, where are you?
For those who are watching on video, there's this like enormous flower behind me. I'm in a hotel room. I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. I guess officially this is Chandler, Arizona. It's the Phoenix area. And this is where Tech Data is hosting their first ever security conference. It's called their Security and Force show. Officially, it began yesterday. Today's sort of like the first full big day of content. And they're doing it here because folks who've been following Tech Data for a long time know that Tech Data bought the technology solutions business from Avnet a couple of years ago. That business was based here in the Phoenix area. And really the big event, the big reason to gather security folks here in Phoenix at the Tech Data facilities in the city right now is that they just opened up. Tech Data did their new cyber range, and we'll be talking about that in a few minutes, but that is located here in Phoenix, and there are shuttle buses running out there all day and bringing folks out and conducting tours of that site and so on. It opened up yesterday.
Well, and that might explain why we have so much Tech Data news to talk about, and you mentioned that they bought out Avnet. Well, it looks like private investors are going to strike again, Rich. Is it serious? A private equity investor is going to acquire Tech Data?
Absolutely. And you know what? You're exactly right. The private equity investments in the IT space right now are coming so fast and furious. It's sort of hard to keep up with them after a while. We are recording this like midday-ish on a Thursday, at least where I am. It's midday-ish on a Thursday. Monday morning, first thing, the world finds out that Carbonite has been acquired for about $1.4 billion. We're going to come back to that a little bit later in the show. And then yesterday morning, Wednesday morning, the news breaks that Tech Data is going to be acquired by a company called Apollo Global Management for about $5.4 billion. Now, Tech Data is listed on the NASDAQ Stock Exchange. This whole thing has to get approved, and it's going to take a little while for that to happen. The board has unanimously approved the deal. It's very likely to go through. So I point that out because in the span of three business days and really like 48 hours, there was something approaching $7 billion of private equity money poured into our segment of the IT world, here. And it's just kind of an astonishing thing. The pace of these deals, is really just accelerating. The Tech Data deal is absolutely brand new. It's like 24 hours old at this point. A little bit hard to kind of prognosticate exactly what it winds up meaning. But I mean, right immediately before we started recording this podcast, I was at the morning's general session at the Security and Force event. Marty Bauerlein, who is the senior vice president in charge of North American sales for Tech Data, delivered a keynote there. And, you know, this was the 90,000 pound or whatever elephant in the room. He was going to talk about it a little bit. And he had kind of an interesting angle on it, basically. And I just immediately before we started recording posted a story on this. The way he put it is he is pleased or will be pleased when the deal is done to get Tech Data off of what he called the 90-day shot clock. And in a conversation with him last night, he kind of likened this to what Dell did when they went private some years back. If you are a publicly listed company, you are beholden to investors. Every 90 days, every 3 months, you put your financials out. Everybody's scrutinizing those numbers. If they see something they don't like, they're going to complain loudly about it. It has a tendency to force companies sometimes into shorter-term thinking. And so now they're going to be a privately held company. And according to Bauerlein, what's great about that for Tech Data is it gets them off this 90-day shot clock. They don't have to be focused on the short term as much anymore. They can think longer term. And, you know, this is a company that's been making investments, longer term investments for a while now. We mentioned the Avnet acquisition. That was a $2.6 billion deal that they did about two years ago. So pretty, you know, long term, significant investment. And it's part of this transformation process that Tech Data has been going through, where they are turning themselves from an old school distributor, meaning they just kind of ship shrink wrapped hardware and software, into a provider of next generation solutions in areas like cloud computing, Internet of Things, big data, et cetera. So they've been on that path before. Now, according to Bauerlein this morning, they are sort of liberated, if you will, to be even more aggressive in terms of that that change process. And, you know, I, needless to say, partners are wondering, what's this going to wind up meaning for me? And really, we don't know. Bauerlein did say, though, that we, you know, Tech Data has always been a customer-focused company. Don't worry, no disruption, no big changes. It's only good things. Time will tell if, you know, if that is really what this all kind of adds up to for Tech Data partners. But I will say Apollo Global Management does not have a history of being a short-term private equity kind of company that flips these investments and then sort of drains companies of cash and all those bad things that private equity companies can do. So there's no reason to be worried about it on that front, at least. But we'll see if this turns out to be a good thing for Tech Data and its partners or not.
Now, the valuation of this buy is $5.4 billion. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, somebody needs to get me the name of the person who is in charge of money over at Apollo Global Management, because I've got a deal for them.
And what's it?
I only need a million is all I need.
A bargain.
I am a bargain compared to Tech Data, I tell you. Wow, that's a lot of money, Rich. Now, this my only other question, does this make Tech Data, it will be private now, but they're still not the only distributor that is privately held, or all of them privately publicly listed?
So D&H is privately held. That's still essentially a family business. Cinex, I'm nearly positive, is publicly traded. Ingram is too, although that gets complicated because their parent company is in China, so they're publicly traded, but not on our stock market, is I believe the way it works. So yeah, I think other than D&H, this would be the biggest totally privately held distributor out there right now.
Very interesting. Rory, your thoughts? Tech Data goes private, bought by private investment. You're seeing a lot of private investment money in the IT channel these days. I'm sure I don't know if you've been approached to be bought by private equity, but wouldn't be surprised if it didn't happen before we're done with this show.
Right. Hopefully you get your million, and you know, I'm going to need, you know, like 1 point, you know, to that's I'm hoping that 1 million is just for you personally. We'll make a deal, right? It's like they get the two of us for $2 million. This is outside of the companies, right? There's no company, there's no stake in anything. Just they get Matt and Rory $2 million. I think that's a bargain.
And apparently a new band.
And we bring the band, right? We get the band. We get Rich the kazoo. We could probably, you know, I think 2.5. Get all three of us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, at least another $50 to $100 if Rich comes along.
So. So Tech Data, I think this is fantastic, right? Like, God bless the Tech Data management and you know the people who built the company over a year. Steve Raymond, who started the company from nothing. I think it was maybe Steve and his father. Was that the story? You know, I'm in Florida, even though we're our company these days is kind of technically based in Tulsa. You know, I was from the Florida arm, so I'm a Florida guy. Tech Data was one of the first distributors I ever did any business with. I think if you try to get an account at Tech Data today, there's like a 7-digit account number. My first Tech Data account number was 3008.
Wow. So
it was a 4-digit account number. We go way, way back. Marty, who spoke, I remember Marty was actually at Ingram Micro once upon a time. And I thought bringing him over to the team was a great thing. We've seen Tech Data become like a new company in the last several years since Steve passed the reins over to Bob Dukowski and then subsequently Rich Hume. Rich is a great guy. IBM background, which I think was the same as Bob, but I think Tech Data for a long time was, they held back a little bit. They didn't do things until they saw other people doing it and being successful. And there weren't that many companies for them to look up to, right? There's a couple of other distributors and let's see what they're doing. And I think with the changes in leadership that have occurred in the last, several years and particularly with now this move, they're really moving into sort of a new paradigm of let's lead and let's make the investments that make sense. And I think this is a great move. Again, we've seen changes in leadership in the past, and how is that going to affect the partners? It's not going to negatively affect the partners, right? Like, you and I aren't going to shell out $5.4 billion and then go, but now let's just change what's been working. Let's change whatever got them to that valuation. So if anything, they're going to get more aggressive and get a bigger piece of the market share. And to do that, they're going to want these global partners that they have to be cheerleaders for them and tell them what a great company Tech Data is. The other guys are bigger. I think there's the one other company that's now acquired by a Chinese company. They're bigger. I believe the numbers over there have always been bigger, and I think they're going to aggressively try to get to grow their piece of the pie.
And the thing that occurred to me this morning, and it came to mind again as you were talking there, Rory. You turn the clock back a few years, right? And cloud computing is taking off, and everything's going online, and the whole distribution business model around pick, pack, and ship, it's just doomed. And therefore, all the distributors are just doomed, right? And we've watched, it's been this trend unfolding for several years here, where we've watched these big distributors reinvent themselves for a new era of IT. They've had to do it. Here we are with this major wealthy private equity firm that, could have put its money in any number of different places. Putting $5.4 billion in one of the leading distributors, it's like it's a statement essentially on how successfully Tech Data in particular, but I would argue all of the big distributors in general, have handled this transition into the cloud, IoT, et cetera, era and have managed to, not only remain viable, very successful businesses, but, relevant businesses to the channel as well. It's been an interesting thing to watch.
Absolutely. Anybody who thought, pick, pack, and ship is the end-all, be-all, forever, that's, I would say, as more and more companies move, into the cloud, there's still hardware to be had. Someone's buying the hardware. It's going somewhere. But the average client and an IT company has to touch it less, particularly if you're embracing some of the big players like your Microsoft and AWS. So you have to imagine that the distributor said, well, we can't have one client or two clients. We can't have all of our hardware is now going to be bought by Amazon and Microsoft, right? We don't really need distribution for that. So I think it was way back the distributors saw that they had, they weren't just pick, pack, and ship. Pick, pack, and ship, I'd say, is a necessary evil because It continues to move product. There's a lot of stuff out there that's moving, and particularly resellers who get started in this business need a place to go in order to, you know, and you don't want to have to, if you're going to sell something from 20 different vendors, you know, you have your Tech Data Ingram and Synnex is, they're like a one-stop shop. You go there, you establish, you know, you can get tech support. You can sort of vet out some vendors because if they're doing business with them, you sort of trust the big distributors to have vetted out some of those vendors. But I think at some point they said, hey, you know, we're a marketing machine as well. We're not just providing pick, pack, and ship. We have the ear, you know, or the ears of a whole ton of resellers, right? Let's call it, I don't know how many customers Tech Data has, but let's just pretend there's, you know, 30, 40,000 resellers around the globe. And now they're a marketing machine to those resellers. So as they begin to step into other areas, you know, we all remember the days of no SKU, no can do, right? If you didn't have a SKU, a number that they could put into the system, they weren't sure how to sell it. So you know, if you had some products and you want to sell to distribution, it was like, how many SKUs do you have? You know, well, you know, we have 10 products and every one of them has 3 different versions, so we have 30 SKUs. Great. You know, but cloud doesn't work that way. Maybe there's a SKU, but it's going to be awfully complicated to have something scalable, you know, like Amazon Web Services and bring it down to the SKU level. So they sort of had to figure out how to get in the middle of that and say, we're a conduit for you cloud companies to get to our 40,000 resellers. And that's what the resellers are looking to them to that continued, well, if they're doing business with you, you're sort of vetting them out for us. There may be vendors, you know, 20 or 30 application vendors that are doing the exact same thing. And you say, well, you know, these guys are part of the Tech Data ecosystem. Already they have a higher level of trust coming from me because Tech Data's vetted them out. They're joining Tech Data's marketing programs. They're sort of like, they're a real company. And I don't know about some of these other guys. And guess what? As I'm buying some things from Tech Data, I can throw that on. I've already got established credit lines. And now I don't have to, you know, I'm continuing to have a one-stop shop instead of going across the board and sort of building my own internal, you know, figuring out what comes from where. So I think that's where these guys have figured out that they can bring a lot of value and plug into the cloud ecosystem and preserve that marketing machine that they've built to their resellers.
You know, and on that note of value, private investors generally don't just park money in companies because they want to treat them like a bank account. Usually they see growth is what attracts investors. They want to make money. Do we really think that there's enough? How much growth potential do you really think there is left in Tech Data?
Well, you know, you can imagine the presentations that the Tech Data executives, you know, might have been making to the folks at Apollo. So, you know, as I said before, their big bet for the future is around solutions, so combinations of hardware, software, and services, which is sort of the new addition, the non-SKU addition to the formula for those guys. They can provide services as well for partners who don't have the capability to do that on their own. But, you know, solutions in these next generation markets. And so if you look at Internet of Things, cloud computing, cybersecurity, and you believe that there's a lot of growth potential in those markets, and you believe that the model that a company like Tech Data has adopted where they're going to help all of these channel pros out there participate in the growth of those markets, then, you know, that's a pretty robust scenario for future growth from an investor's point of view.
Yeah, Rory, you think there's a lot of growth that Tech Data is capable of in the next 5 years?
You know, these distributors, I thought it was pretty incredible numbers back when, I forget, you know, I don't want to quote exact numbers, but I remember there was a time when, let's say Ingram Micro was doing like $26 billion a year and it seems like Tech Data was maybe 10 billion behind them. And you know, and Synnex maybe had a smaller piece of that pie, but you look at those numbers today, they've all added billions of dollars of top line revenue. So there's a couple places to go, right? It's the industry is continuing to grow, and you can start taking a piece of the pie from the other guys. So I think Tech Data is going to get aggressive and continue to grow, and I think we can expect to see some growth there.
Absolutely. And one of those areas where I think Tech Data is seeing growth is in cybersecurity. In fact, they now have a funhouse of cybersecurity. Am I reading this right, Rich?
That's exactly right. And that's really why I'm here. So I mean, the reason they're hosting this event here in Phoenix, as I said before, really is because this is this week is the grand opening of their new cyber range, which is out here. And that, quite honestly, is the main reason I'm out here. I mean, I'm attending the conference, but mostly I'm here because a few months back they invited me to come and visit the cyber range and be at the grand opening. And if you're the kind of person who geeks out on security a little bit, that's an irresistible invitation. So I came out to Phoenix, and yesterday was the big ribbon cutting, the folks at Tech Data were good enough to give our buddy Channel Pro associate publisher Joel Zadespinner and I a tour, our own little tour, first thing in the morning yesterday before anyone else got a chance to look at the new cyber range. We got a chance to wander around it a little bit. So what is a cyber range? And the Tech Data folks get asked this a lot. And really, it has a number of different missions. But first and foremost, it's a place where people can come, partners can come to hone their cybersecurity skills. And so that there's traditional sort of classroom instruction being offered here, instructor-led training. There's online training, pre-recorded training available, but the really cool, interesting training that you can get at the cyber range is you come in and essentially in a simulated, very realistic environment, they throw a bunch of real live malware at you and you get to actually deal with it and, you know, test your skills at coping with a situation like that. And there's a whole new service that Tech Data has rolled out called the Incident Response Experience, which is not even just for the technicians. It's like you can bring in a whole team of people, and the business decision makers and the technical guys can all sort of deal with this pretend scenario and see how effectively they would respond to an incident in real time. So they all sorts of really kind of state-of-the-art gear for practicing, experiencing, dealing with real-world cybersecurity threats in a safe environment. And that's kind of a key thing. One of the key points that Tech Data emphasized about the cyber range is if you think about it, there really aren't too many places you can go to do this right now. It's like you can't experiment with real-life malware and see how effectively you defend against it on your own network. You know, you're going to get fired if you try that. You can't do it in a customer environment. They're going to fire you if you try it. You don't have the resources to do it at home. You can do it in a lot of cases with a vendor, but even there are a lot of vendors in the cyber range. And I met with a guy from Fortinet yesterday, and he was the first to admit, we can do some of this kind of stuff with you, but it's all going to be about Fortinet. So, I mean, if you want to put together a combination of tools from different vendors and subject that to real world conditions and see how it performs, there aren't too many places to go do that. So the cyber range is it's kind of filling this niche, this need in the industry, and it's really kind of hard to point to a lot of other places that are doing what Tech Data is doing there right now.
So it's like a giant escape room.
Yeah in a lot of ways. And you know, the element of fun, I mean, so one of the things that Tech Data said is you can come here to learn, you can bring your customers here and use this as a demo facility or a testing facility for something that they're considering to buy, or if the facility is available, you can come stage an event here just because it's kind of a fun place to be. And words like, hey, this is like a kid's science museum. You know, you can press buttons and touch things and lights flash. And there was a lot of that too. It's just kind of an interesting place to be on top of everything else.
Wow. Rory, are you going to go to the cybersecurity funhouse?
I think we, you know, it's absolutely something that we could leverage. We were actually in conversations with some folks who were trying to stand up a cyber range in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And we were in conversation with them about us being part of the team that that managed it. I don't know that, that's happening at this point. There used to only be maybe 8 or 10 cyber ranges in the country. Lately, I think a couple of universities have stood up some other ones. Tech Data is interesting because I think it's the first one that a commercial entity has stood up specifically for their clients and probably their vendors to come play in the sandbox. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, my definition of a cyber range, it's a controlled environment so that you can throw real malware around and it's not going to get out into the open so that you're not guilty of releasing malware out into the, you know, out into the internet. So, you know, the systems are designed to simulate, you know, using real malware, but the bad guys is what you're simulating. And then you can throw the book at something. So this is a place where software vendors could bring their software to do some of their own internal testing. Anybody who's building any sort of a security product has to eventually end up in a cyber range so that they can test and see if you know their security product really stands up to some of the things that are out there. And you know, hopefully, like any good cyber range, there's a few companies out there that are on the cutting edge of, say, capturing, you know, the 100,000 pieces of new malware that become available every day and then feeding it to the cyber range. Other uses of cyber range are actually testing some of your security people and doing some sort of a cyber hunt, bringing, you know, people in and saying, all right, here's some systems. Here's some IP addresses, here's some tools, and let's see if you can crack it open. This is some of the things that that maybe some federal agencies do when looking to hire some of the folks that are helping protect them. As you're going to go out and do penetration testing on others, well, we need to see how good you are at penetration testing. And, you know, they'll give you a network and see if you can hack it, because maybe they've already determined there's one way to hack it and one piece of information that they want to see if you can get at. And you know, hit go, and whoever gets to it the fastest wins, you know, that sort of thing. So there's really a lot of you know, a lot of uses that a cyber range can be used for. It you just put the picture up there, but you know, a really cool looking one with lots of blinky lights, right? That's going to attract people.
This is also very useful for Fortnite frag parties.
Absolutely.
Right now, okay. So, Rich, you got to take a tour, and we're taking a look at one of the pictures that you took while you were there, and we'll look at a couple of them. What was your impression of the space?
You know, needless to say, it's the kind of question I ask. How much did you guys spend on this? They wouldn't give me the exact number. Later on, they said, let's just say it's a seven-figure number. And confidentially, just between you and me and the lamppost, I was talking to a Tech Data executive who said, yeah, it's a little conservative. It was more than that. You know it when you walk into this space. It took them a year to build it. They put a lot of money into it, and it really does feel like this very cool kind of state-of-the-art facility. So, I mean, from the standpoint of bringing a customer in, I think that alone actually would be, you know, it would make an impact, essentially, to present yourself as somebody who has access to this kind of resource.
So in order to use the cyber range, I would have to assume you have to be a vendor that works with Tech Data or a Tech Data partner, I would assume.
Yep, correct.
And is there costs for using this?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think not for the most part. It probably depends on how much work they have to do to kind of create an experience, an engagement for you. But I'm not actually 100% sure of that. I'm sure, you know, obviously if you come there and you stage an event or something like that, there are probably, you know, catering costs and all that kind of a thing. But I don't know very much about how much they charge just to come in for half a day or whatever and run a demo for a customer or train some of your techs.
And do they do children's birthday parties?
I'll bet they do.
I say we just drop Marty Bauerlein's name and go, Marty said, I can come use the Cyber Range whenever the catering's on him. Does he watch your podcast? I'm going to get a nasty text message.
Well, we're going to make sure he does after that statement.
Absolutely. Count me in.
Well, that's awesome. Very cool. Very cool thing to build. And I'm glad we got a tour. We've got links to this tour and to the news stories that we're talking about here out of Tech Data on the show notes page. Channel4network.com is where it's at. Just find episode 124. And you'll see links to all this. If you're watching on YouTube, if you go to the show description area, we have links to all of the stories in there, so you can kind of read along and follow as we talk about it. And of course, if you're on YouTube, make sure you hit the subscribe button and the bell to get notifications when we have new shows. So, Richard, anything else you want to talk about Tech Data before we move on?
No, I think that's good.
All right. So, well, let's just keep the old companies buying companies story front and center. And I swear to God, Rich, didn't Carbonite just buy somebody that we just talked about and now they're being bought?
Webroot.
Yeah, right. So we got the big fish eating the little fish, and now a bigger fish has come along. And yeah. Now they're swallowing Carbonite. And who is OpenText? Rich, tell me about this.
You know, I mean, that is actually a perfect question to set this up with, because there's even less that we can say definitively about this acquisition, precisely because there are probably a lot of people who read Channel Pro and are listening to the podcast now who are wondering, you know, who is OpenText? OpenText is actually a very big, very successful information management company. We have just barely written about them at Channel Pro, though, because they are really focused, for the most part, have been historically, on the enterprise. From their perspective, what was exciting about the opportunity to buy Carbonite is very big in the SMB space, as we know, and also in what some folks call the prosumer space, the micro business consumer kind of segment. So from an OpenText standpoint, buying Carbonite, it allows them to significantly expand their cloud computing portfolio and really make a strategic and pretty aggressive move into the SMB space, into the consumer space. But it's, I don't even know all that much about OpenText, and precisely because they're new to those markets, it's a little bit hard to know what this acquisition is going to wind up meaning for the companies that are involved in it. So, I mean, just to recap what you were saying, way back at the beginning of the year, Carbonite bought Webroot, and this was part of a strategic move that Carbonite was making to kind of reposition itself. Instead of just being a BDR vendor, they were going to be a data protection vendor, which means backup plus security. And then that was also going to enable Carbonite to kind of move beyond its traditional channel, which is mostly VARs, into the MSP space as well, because Webroot is very strong with MSPs. And so now the combined company for about $1.4 billion gets purchased by an enterprise company. From their perspective, data protection, backup, and security is kind of an extension of a lot of the information management kinds of things that they were doing before, moves them into a different market. But this is definitely one of those areas where it'll be interesting to see how disruptive this ends up being for the companies that have gotten acquired, and how forceful OpenText is in sort of putting its fingerprints on these. Does it sort of stand back in a certain sense and allow Webroot to keep doing what has been very successful for Webroot? And Webroot has been a success story in the managed services space for a number of years now. If you look at the Carbonite leadership team right now, there are a lot of ex-Webroot executives in senior positions at Carbonite now, precisely because there's this enormous opportunity among MSPs, and Webroot has been so good at going after MSPs. Does OpenText stand back and say, they know what they're doing, let's let them do it and help them do it, but not get in the way? Or do they start putting the finger on the scale in one way or another and kind of trying to redirect things? I don't know OpenText well enough to know what to predict.
Yeah, Rory, I want to get your take on this, because you are a CEO. If in your experience, if a company comes along who has a lot of experience, especially at the enterprise level, which is not always translatable to the SMB market, they're kind of different beasts in a lot of ways. Do you see this as problematic for Carbonite going forward?
You know, I don't know about problematic, but the question is, you know, why, you know, what's behind this acquisition? What are they thinking? Do they have, maybe it's a play to get some of their solutions into the SMB space. And this is, you know, the, you know, Carbonite is highly consumer. There's a lot of individuals who use Carbonite. I think Carbonite had come up with some solutions that kind of play in the SMB space as well. And Webroot has had a lot of success in the MSP space. So I'm wondering if OpenText has some solutions that, right, they say that the SMB space is like 700 times the size of the enterprise space, even though enterprise customers are, it's a larger ticket item. But maybe they have some things that they think they can push out to that space through partners that's maybe not traditionally how it's been done. Or are they looking to acquire some technology that these other guys have, that, you know, that Carbonite has, and they're wanting to incorporate some of that technology into some of their core product line, which could mean that at some point down the road, they look at Carbonite, they look at Webroot, and if it's not meeting their, you know, their numbers criteria, they take what they need and then either spin it off or shut it down. We saw, you know, there was a great anti-spam product called MX Logic. That MX Logic was bought by McAfee. McAfee supported it a number of years, and then MX Logic went away. Why did they acquire that company? It looked like they really liked some of the things that MX Logic was doing. They got some of the folks who built it, supported it for a while, and said, you know, we got what we needed out of it. Lots of people thought they should sell it to someone. They should sell it to me. I love the product. I want to keep using it. They're like, it's none of that's really worth it for what we're trying to do, and just shut it down. So it's hard to say when a big enterprise company, you know, buys a different solution that doesn't look like it's part of their core offering. You kind of wonder what are they looking for? And you know, again, 1.4 billion, I think, is what I heard. That's a big number. So you've got to get the, you know, there's got to be a plan that we don't know what the plan is.
Yeah. Well, and you had an interesting angle on that I wonder about a little bit. So Carbonite buys Webroot to go from backup to data protection, like this bigger definition of what we do with data. We secure it as well as back it up. You wonder if OpenText is viewing this as an opportunity to go broader still. So it's all about data, right? Like, you know, the new currency of the new economy and so on. We secure it, we back it up, we archive it, we organize it, we make it searchable. You know, we are the information people. That is something theoretically that they could do. They could start kind of merging these technologies, as you were saying, and really kind of building this end-to-end kind of information-centered platform. I don't know if that's where they're going or not, but it certainly does make you wonder.
So the OpenText is buying them for $1.42 billion. How big of a company is OpenText?
You know, I would have to go look up the financials to see what, you know, how much cash they were sitting on when they made this deal and what their revenue looked. I don't know, but it's a pretty big company.
I don't think I've ever heard of them, and I can only imagine like the guy who's like leading the board at Carbonite was like, you know, his employee busts in and is like, sir, we got a guy on the phone. He wants to buy us from OpenText. And the guy goes, who? He's got $1.5 billion sold. Like that's how this happened. I'm seeing in my head.
As of 2012, they call themselves the global leader in enterprise information management.
So. See, and they're just enterprise. They're just kind of out of my purview, I guess.
That's the thing. That's exactly the thing. And that's what makes this, you know, there's so much mystery somehow around this particular acquisition, because OpenText is just not, you know, very often on our radar at Channel Pro because of that enterprise orientation. I have contacts on the PR side. Every now and again, I'm in touch with somebody over there, but I really don't know very much about that company because they're so new to the SMB space.
I also noticed that their CEO, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce that last name, but he is their CEO and CTO. He does two jobs. I am guessing he doesn't get out much. Rory, if you were a CEO and a CTO, would you get out a whole lot?
No. That's probably a good thing to be, however, because that means that, you know, that kind of puts him as the innovation leader there, right? That means he's like, hey, I'm the chief technology officer. I'm the guy with the ideas. I'm probably, you know, leading the innovation and the way that enterprise information management is going. And then I'm going to be the CEO, so I make sure people do what I want to do. Right?
He probably doesn't have time to join our band, though. I'm kind of
probably doesn't have time for the band. Sounds like a busy guy. But you know, I don't know. Maybe if you've got a spare $1.4 billion around, you can make time for the band as well. We don't know.
Yeah. So, well, we'll have to see what happens with Carbonite as we go forward. So, Rich, keep an eye on them. And follow the news, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about them again as we start to see what the vision is and the whole purpose kind of behind this acquisition for them and what their intentions are going forward. But I want to keep this train moving because we still have a lot to talk about, and I don't want to keep Mr. Rory here for longer than we absolutely have to. Let's see, where Dell is back in the news. Dell Technologies has a sweeping as a service purchasing program. Well, we've been talking a lot about, I'm assuming this is hardware as a service. Am I correct?
Mostly, because that's mostly what they do. But I mean, what makes this announcement this week from Dell sweeping is it covers pretty much everything that they offer right now.
And so that they're selling brooms.
We can look that up. They might have a SKU for that. I don't know. It's a big company, actually. So who knows?
Sweeping as a service. I like it. Okay.
Sorry, what was that?
Sweeping as a service.
Oh, I get you. I got you. Yeah. So this is the latest development in this sort of ongoing trend, especially in the world of hardware. Where we know that end users are increasingly eager to purchase everything. They've gotten acclimated to, very used to, they're very fond of buying software from cloud providers on as-a-service basis via subscriptions, and they love the idea of buying everything that way. And so both distributors and hardware manufacturers have been moving aggressively to accommodate that demand. HP has been doing this kind of thing since 2016, I believe, and they've got a very robust as-a-service kind of offering. We've talked about the as-a-service purchasing options from Ingram and D&H and Tech Data and Synnex, and everybody is doing that these days. There has been some of that available from Dell as well in the past, but this is really their first big end-to-end, everything we sell as a service move. And it encompasses server hardware, storage, their entire client business, storage software. I mean, you know, pretty much everything they make is now available on a subscription basis through this announcement that they made. And again, it's just really an indicator of what buyers are looking for now and where the market is going. Pretty much anything you can't buy on an OpEx basis at this point will probably be available that way before too long down the road.
Now, Rory, do you see hardware as a service or this kind of buying model being the future for pretty much all business-to-business IT?
Perhaps. Like yes and no. If they do it properly, then I think there could be a big value not only to them, but also to Dell partners. You guys know that in the MSP world, what we've always told manufacturers is, I bill my clients by the month. I need you to sell me stuff by the month. And a number of vendors have struggled with that. Similar to distribution, we need something to sell. Obviously they have hard costs in building something. So then, if I said, hey, it cost me $300 to build this, but you want me to sell it to you at $30 a month. Well, if you stop paying me in the first year, I'm not really making the money that I needed to make. And technically as a service says, there shouldn't necessarily be long-term contracts. I need to consume this. You provide it to me and I use it for 6 months. And at the end of 6 months, I don't need it anymore. I should be able to stop paying for it. On the other hand, and it doesn't make sense when you're talking about one item, but let's say I'm a 30-user law firm, and I believe that I'm going to grow to being a 40-user law firm. So I don't want to have those expenditures to hire the next 10 people, put PCs at their desk, and I don't know when I'm going to hire someone or whether or not I'm going to have them year-round or seasonal. I want it to scale according to my business. So if I hire 3 more people to sit at those desks, the PCs turn on and they work, and I'm paying for everything, sort of by the month. I pay for my Windows OS. I'm paying for my Microsoft licenses. I'm paying for the PC. So I know my cost for hiring another worker and filling that space, right? They have a phone, maybe I'm using Skype, whatever it is, I turn it all on by the month. And let's say I'm an accountant, and during tax season, I need more people. And when tax season ends, I need less people. I should be able to turn those off. That's really what as a service means. A lot of the people who have tried to do as a service in the past, it's at the end of the day, the minute that there's a long-term contract and some commitments, it's maybe more of a lease program. And just using the as a service buzzword, I haven't tuned into exactly all the buzz that Dell's generated here in the last week with what they're doing as a service. But my thing is, if you're doing it properly, it's going to. I think it could be very good for them as well as their partners. One thing they need to figure out, and this is a part where sales managers and sales VPs always have a really tough time, is how do you book the revenue? Because if you sell 1,000 PCs today, you get to book the revenue of 1,000 PCs. But when you sell 1,000 PCs at, let's call it $30 a month, well, you're not going to get all the revenue now. It's going to take you maybe 3 years to get all the revenue. And how do they count that? Do they count the contract? Do they count, how much revenue comes in today? And a lot of times vendors, I'm talking about manufacturers, have a hard time figuring out how to book revenue that doesn't come in all at once and that they have to recognize over time. That's been some of the hurdles, but I admire their spunk in trying to go in that direction.
And the vendor in this case still owns the capital expense, right? It's not like they're selling the PC. They still own it.
Right, It would. It should be right. It should be theirs. What you need is compute power, and we have this box that's going to deliver it to you, and we give it to you, and then you can turn it on and off as you need it. Sounds like that would be what I call as a service, but technically it's not yours, right? So, So if at some point you go, I'm never going to need this thing again, you should be able to sell it back to them. And you would think that they could repurpose it and make it available to the next person who wants a PC as a service. And then the question becomes, if I were them, because it's interesting, I actually pitched this to somebody many, many moons ago, but at which point do they give you the PC and it's the PC and it's also managed? So
do I would assume the MSP manages it, not Dell in this case, right?
I would think that at this point the MSP is managing it. But you know, how far to go is it when one of these companies who's the manufacturer sells, well, you know, remote management X number of dollars, and I'll tell you what, I just make it available to you at X number of dollars a month and it's managed, right? It comes with managed AV, it comes with support desk, it comes with all the things, and that's where the MSPs are not gonna like it, because that's their bread and butter.
Right. So Rich, was there anything in here about Dell offering this direct, or is this only for MSPs?
They do offer this direct, but probably mostly to larger businesses. I don't know that they're going to be all that eager to be dealing direct with smaller companies. But, you know, I talk to partners sometimes out there who run into Dell subsidiaries, you know, like SecureWorks or something like that, who are courting SMB customers. So it's not inconceivable, actually, that kind of thing would happen here.
Yeah. All right. Well, very interesting. Rich, anything else you want to say on this before we move to the next story?
No.
Yeah. So, I mean, okay. Wrap this one up, though. We're seeing this from all the vendors. It's something that's in demand. I don't think... How do I put this? It doesn't seem like in going forward in business, anybody wants to own the computer, right? Because a computer at the end of its life is a useless box. So this is definitely something good for the MSP. I don't know how this works as well for the manufacturer. It seems like to me, they would want to sell the box, move the box, make the next box, not keep all the boxes for themselves and rent them out. Right? Rory, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, the PC is a little bit more interesting than what some other vendors are producing. If you take any firewall company, they will tell you they're a software company, and that box is just a delivery mechanism. So they can make their firewalls available virtual. Many of them will let you put it onto your own appliance if you have your own appliance. Of course, they've built an appliance that is ideally suited to deliver their software on it. When you get to PCs, it's a little bit different because you've got the manufacturer and then you've got the OS. Dell doesn't own, you know, if they're putting it out there with Windows. So they could say, well, it's just a delivery mechanism for the Windows OS and these other things that you might need, the applications. But is there really a big value in that? Because at that point, like you can get anyone's box, right? There's not a huge differentiator. So it's interesting, but you're right. At the end of the day, people enjoy the CapEx model, or I'm sorry, the OpEx model. And you know, as I'm bringing employees on, I know that there's a cost. I have to give them a cell phone. I have to get them health insurance. I have to get them a PC, and I want to know how much that's going to cost me by the month.
Well, and the whole monthly pricing, that is really kind of the linchpin of this. And I don't see anything in here that says like how much they charge per month for a computer. But if it costs them $300 to build a computer, they could sell it for $599, assuming that they're going to make that much margin on hardware, which they're probably not going to. But if they can sell it for $30 a month and keep it in operation for 4 years, they do make a hell of a lot more money on that box than if they'd sold it outright.
And then at the end of that device's lifespan, they just slip a new device in place of the old one, and the customer is happy because it's just another monthly payment. It's not like some big refresh cycle. So
right, and Dell can either the manufacturer could either recycle the thing or throw it out used and sell it cheap, but they could still recover some of the cost there after they sell it out. So it seems like it might be a good model for the hardware manufacturers, because they might make more money this way than if they just sold the box directly. But then I would wonder, well, then why wouldn't the MSP want to buy the box and then they make more money on the hardware, which is kind of the model I've been talking about for years, buying these low cost, but pretty powerful computers. You sell them with your bundle, on a monthly basis. You might have sold them a computer for $300 in the past. Well, now you're going to charge them $15 a month for the thing. And you might do that for 5 years and make, four times what you would have made selling them a box.
And that is what some partners do. I mean, we just last week we were in Newark, we were doing Channel Pro's last live event of the year. And I moderated a panel on managed everything, as we talked about it, and managed hardware was one of the topics we talked about. And, there are partners out there who will acquire the hardware and then offer it on a subscription kind of basis to their customers. And there are, some legal implications and tax implications and most especially financing issues that you kind of have to deal with. If you do the math right, basically, it can actually be, I mean, if anything, it's such a good deal, for the MSPs who are skilled at offering this kind of business that sometimes the end users sort of figure it out and it's like, well, maybe I'm better off just buying something, even though I would prefer to have that certainty, you were talking about Rory and so on, but, if done right, it can be a very lucrative model.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of lucrative models, I'm seeing this a lot, and this is what Cloud Oak just launched, a business continuity planning and orchestration solution. Now, are they actually using the word orchestration in their marketing?
Well, it certainly in my conversation with them, yes.
So that's a pretty big word to use in 2020 to describe a product. What do you think, Rich? Is this... what is this? Tell me about it.
So most folks, most Channel Pro readers, they hear the words business continuity and they immediately go to BDR, backup. So keeping data available and operational when a system goes down. But really, business continuity is more than that. If a company's office burns down, getting the IT workloads up and running again is part of what you have to deal with. But there are a whole bunch of other things. A business continuity plan, a true complete business continuity plan, goes way beyond just the IT, right? I mean, there are issues like just figuring out where everyone is going to work from, confirming that, that the office just burned down in our scenario here. Is everybody okay? Do we know where everybody is? There are a lot of different things that have to happen when a business continuity plan needs to go into effect. And so what Cloud Oak has done, and Cloud Oak, I should say, is a very young, very new Canadian company. They initially came out with the BDR product. In August, they sort of previewed the system that they call Plan for Continuity, and it is now a sort of officially completely gone into general availability. And what it really is designed to do is help an MSP help their customer build a complete end-to-end business continuity plan. And then if something terrible happens, you can use this tool, which is hosted in the cloud, to actually execute the plan. So you could have multiple plans. You could go to one customer and say, we're going to set up a plan for you if your office is destroyed. But we're also going to set up a plan for you if there is an active shooter situation somewhere nearby or any of the other things that could potentially disrupt a business. You could have multiple plans with one customer. If one of these things happens, whoever is authorized to trigger the plan goes into the Plan for Continuity console and presses what the chief strategy officer at Cloud Oak likes to call the Oh My God button. You press the Oh My God button, something terrible has happened. And your plan starts to kind of execute, and it reminds you, okay, first thing you need to do is go out and use this tool's roll call feature to figure out where everybody is, and it will sort of automatically send a text out to everybody, and everybody reports in, and you can see where everybody is and who's safe and who's unaccounted for in one place. If, you know, again, a tornado knocked the office down, well, what hardware, what equipment, not even just IT, but what did I have in the office there that I don't have anymore? What's under warranty? Who's it from? Who do I call? Who's, you know, all that information is gathered for you. So that's the orchestration aspect of it. So from an MSP standpoint, what's significant about this is, first of all, there are a lot of end users who will come to an MSP looking for help with this, and MSPs don't necessarily know how to build a business continuity plan. So apparently what a lot of them do right now is just do a Google search, essentially, for a business continuity plan. There are templates out there, and you know they take a Word document, and they sit down with the customer and fill out the Word document, and you know, in the event of an earthquake, where are you going to be able to find that, and how useful really is it, and so on. So this tool is providing a lot of expertise, essentially, you can tap into for how to build a good business continuity plan. And then it's also allowing the MSP to turn business continuity planning into a new service offering. Dave Seibert, he's been a guest host on the podcast multiple times before. He's a speaker at our events very regularly. I remember talking about this with him years ago. This is something that he's been doing with his clients for a while, is helping them with business continuity planning. And it's not just IT continuity, it's just the whole deal. And he's really found it to be, you know, something that customers appreciate, and it deepens relationships, but it's also been a moneymaker for his company. And so here's a tool that will kind of help you, if that sounds interesting, that can help you actually get into that service and deliver it in you know, somewhat automated way that doesn't require you to acquire a degree in business continuity.
Yeah, there's a lot here to digest. Rory, is business continuity something that you've accounted for in your business?
Yeah, absolutely. What I hope comes from this is teaching, making it easy or easier for MSPs to be able to deliver a business continuity solution to their clients, not just the solution, but the planning. There's a lot that goes into it. And where, one place where I think MSPs have struggled is trying to figure out exactly how they make money and get paid for their time in the business continuity planning part of this. I would say that everybody is doing data backup, and data backup is going to provide some sort of business continuity, but it's not the end-all be-all. It may just be a piece. You know, to properly do business continuity and disaster recovery planning, you sort of have to, you know, look at the business and figure out, ask a whole bunch of questions. You know, what are the systems that need to be back up and running, you know, as soon as possible? What systems can we be without for a little while? Most importantly, what will our clients find acceptable? I like to say, you know, if we look back at one of the biggest disasters of our time was, the World Trade Center in 2001. American Express, I believe, had a processing center at that building. And obviously a main processing center in the U.S. went down, and a few hours later they were processing credit cards as if the buildings were still there. If you and I were trying to use a credit card in some foreign country, we would go, hey, there's a terrible disaster that occurred over there, but it's sort of unacceptable that I can't get gas now because of that. They should have thought around that, and I believe they won some awards for their processes and the way they were able to continue doing business soon afterwards. And that's systems, right? You have to identify each individual system. I like to say, if eBay's website went down, it would probably make national news, right? This eBay, or in this case, Amazon these days, really sort of conducts all their business over the web. I don't even know there's a way of calling them. On the other hand, you take a business that is highly dependent on their phone system. Well, you're going to want to get the phone system up. I used to say, if my phone system was down, people would know right away. If my website was down, maybe nobody would notice, right away, because we used to transact a lot more business over the telephone. So you kind of have to pick a company apart and plan for those various things. What will my customer find acceptable? You know, when we were 100% based in West Palm Beach, I said, if a storm came by, and, you know, my West Palm Beach clients would understand if we were down for a couple of days, because they're probably down for a couple of days if there's no power in West Palm Beach. And everyone is down. No one is expecting, you know, when there's no power, why isn't this company up and assisting us? At the same time, as you start doing business regionally or across the country or globally, it's a different set of expectations from your clients, and you have to plan accordingly. In the SMB space, I think a lot of MSPs approach their client with business continuity planning, and the client says, sure, do it. Don't charge me anything for it. Isn't that part of what I'm paying you for? Right? You guys manage my stuff, so I guess keeping it up and running, and like that's your problem. Not me. And you know, I think one thing that'll come from this is, you know, MSPs, I think all the time, are better defining their offering and what is included. And that opens up the avenue to say, hey, here's something that is not included in what we do for you, but we think it's really important. And this tool is going to help us not only be able to help you, you know, decide what to do in case of a disaster and how you protect your business and keep your business going, but then also help orchestrate the things that are, you know, that need to happen. So I think it's an opportunity for MSPs, and kudos for them. For this is something people have been talking about for a long, long time. And they say first of its kind business continuity planning tool. And I haven't seen the tool, but I believe it, that it's probably first of its kind. This has sort of been the redheaded stepchild that nobody's talking about.
Yeah, you know, when I first heard about it in back in August, it was at the CompTIA ChannelCon show. I first got my glimpse of Plan for Continuity. And I remember my first thought was, how could there not be 7 products on the market already doing this? It's like, as they're describing what it does to me, I'm thinking, the need for this is so obvious. How could there not be other products? But I don't know any either that do this.
And it'd be really great if included in this is testing of the plan. That's one thing that happens a lot in business continuity planning is when it actually comes time to execute the plan, if folks haven't walked through it and tested it, you know, things still tend to go a little awry because sometimes you don't know if you've got all the right policies and procedures in place until you walk through it and test them.
An interesting angle on that. So we were talking about how orchestration is a big part of what's involved with this tool. The longer term vision for the product is automation, where, you know, to the extent possible, the system would actually perform some of the steps in the business continuity plan for you. But one of the complications there that I spoke about with the folks who run CloudOak is that testing scenario. If you do that and you're not kind of careful about how you set that up and what you allow people to sort of simulate versus actually do, if you are testing a plan, you can actually go out and do something, you know, in the real world as opposed to just test it, that could be a problem. So it's one of the wrinkles that they're kind of thinking through as they pursue that that longer term goal.
Oh, and I got to tell you, think of the add-ons that you can do when you're talking about business continuity with one of your customers. This opens up the door for all kinds of things that you can sell. Like, you would talk about, like, what happens if the building burns down? Boom, I've got fire extinguishers in stock ready. What if there's a flood? You can start selling rafts, right? What if you die? I got life insurance. We'll take care of the kids and the wife and the husband. For you and all your employees, we got life insurance plans. Buckets, because you gotta, if there's water in the building, you gotta have bucketed out, right? Rory, what things would you sell alongside this?
Yeah, it's unlimited, right? You can just start somewhere and keep going from there. By the way, back on our previous thing where we're talking about as a service, I thought you and I should get a van and start a as a service asset recovery service. So you know, when people stop using as a service stuff, you and I show up in the van, you know, take everything and, you know, get a finder's fee back for returning people's hardware to them. But,
oh, that's an eBay business right there, right, man.
That's it. That's it. Right. We got it.
And it's the as a service band.
As a service van with the band. Right. So, there's, you know, but I really think that for an MSP to define their offering and be very clear about what's included and what's not, you know, and some people will say, well, everything is included. But you can't just keep coming up with new things that are included at no additional charge. I'm a big fan in not nickel and diming the clients to death, but there is such a thing as your MSP offering and maybe some add-ons, because maybe not every client needs all of it. But when you've got the right client, this is something that I think, until every MSP on the planet is doing it, the early adopters are going to, you know, use this as a differentiator. And come in the door, and maybe someone's unhappy with the current MSP, and they walk in the door and they go, hey, here's what we're doing. And I think that's where they need to include some security offerings, and they need to come in with a tool like this. And well, is your current MSP giving you all of these things? No, they've never talked to us about that. They've never talked to us about this.
And right. every MSP who has customers in tall buildings has wanted to sell parachutes as a service. for those disasters. So this is an opportunity there. We're going to move on, but it's a very, very cool solution, and we're going to watch them, Rich, because anytime there's a new thing that, like, I can't believe somebody didn't think of this yet, like, there should be seven tools. Next week, there probably will be seven tools. So I have a feeling that this space is going to explode over the next 12 months. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I don't know, but I mean, I won't call it a safe prediction, but yeah, I mean, if they really have kind of hit upon something here, it wouldn't be surprising at all if some other people and you know, if nothing else, they have done something different, right? Something original, which is always welcome. You know, like I get asked sometimes at shows, what are you seeing here you haven't seen before? Well, I mean, here was something I saw at a show a few months ago I just haven't seen before.
All right. Well, that wraps up our news for this particular show, but we got two other stories that we're going to talk about. And one of them, I mean, ever since Colorado legalized marijuana for recreational use, it is definitely a market that is growing. According to this, it's time to inhale a new opportunity. Clever. Very clever writing there. Rich, tell us about this story. It's called Cannabusiness is Big Business. There's a lot of money in this. So what is this trying to say?
Well, so the cannabusiness segment, the legalized marijuana business, if you will, it's a new one. It's growing very rapidly. It's probably in the article. I'm not actually looking at the article right now, but the number of states that in one way or another offer legal access to marijuana. If it's not 50 yet, we're getting there soon. So just in terms of its impact on the economy, cannabis is a big deal and it's getting bigger. It turns out that the companies that grow and distribute and sell legalized marijuana are, you know, robust consumers of IT. There are a lot of IT needs and in particular managed IT needs associated with cannabis. Now, the example of this I'm most familiar with is the state of California, and only because we all know a gentleman named Luis Alvarez, who is an MSP in Northern California, in Salinas, California. He's been a sort of progressive thinker in various markets for many years. He's appeared in the cover of our magazine. He's spoken at our events. And lo and behold, he was very early to this cannabis opportunity. And so just from some of his speaking appearances on this topic at our show and conversations I've had with him, I know a little bit about what is entailed just in the state of California. And just to kind of give you an idea, I mean, there are very specific rules, provisions in the laws governing the sale of marijuana in California that, as a for example, you have got to have 24/7 absolutely nonstop surveillance camera footage of any place that stores or sells marijuana. If the network goes down, if the camera goes down, if you can't see into every corner of the store for whatever reason, you have to just close your door, lock up your door, and shut. You're not allowed to be in business until that surveillance is restored. And I mean, and that's really kind of just a starting point. I mean, there's obviously a lot of physical security needs in terms of securing these spaces. There are a lot of the same kinds of needs that more or less any retail, you know, in the retail outlets for legalized marijuana, that they have a lot of the same point of sale needs and
a lot of needs for snacks too, right, Rich?
What was that?
They have a lot of needs for snacks too, like M&Ms and Doritos.
They probably do, yeah. So, you know, the vending machine has to be available nonstop or it could get ugly. Yeah. So there's a lot of technology in this business, and it, because it has to be continuously available, there is a model there for an MSP to get involved. It's a very new business. So essentially, for the MSPs who start investigating this and getting in on it now, that this is an opportunity to be early to what is looking to be a pretty big opportunity down the road.
So, Rory, are you finding now? You're in Florida, correct? Is that a state where marijuana is legal? I can't follow these anymore.
I believe in Florida, you can get a medical marijuana card.
Okay, so you don't have a lot of growers in Florida yet, but you have a much bigger footprint than just Florida.
Yeah, there's been a lot of activity in Oklahoma along the same lines. I believe medical marijuana is legal there, but you know, we do work with folks in a number of states, and we've worked on a couple of projects, not really from an MSP perspective, but working more on the IoT side of things. We do some stuff around IoT security. We've got some background in industrial control systems, and it's all sort of going to IoT now. And what's interesting is that agriculture in general is really starting to embrace a lot of IoT. And because of the amount of money that was being dumped into the cannabis business, they're sort of, believe it or not, the cannabis growers are sort of leading some of the thought leadership there in agriculture and how you can utilize IoT and the data that we get from IoT. But like Rich was saying, I think one of the primary rules in California is the surveillance thing in the stores, but then they're also concerned just about the real estate and where they're growing. I got to visit one cannabis farm, and it was there were greenhouses, but the greenhouses were surrounded by blueberry farms. You know, just blueberries as far as the eye can see. And I asked them about the blueberries, and they said, "Well, we make sure there's always about half a mile of blueberries between where we're growing cannabis and the nearest road," actually as a bit of a buffer. They said, no one ever tries to steal our blueberries. But some of the folks that we talked to were actually interested in detecting whether or not anyone was walking around in the blueberries, let's say. And, one company we talked to was interested in, well, you know, we need to watch out for animals and people. And if we detect something, we want to launch a drone and have the drone go over and tell us, is it an animal? Is it a person? Because let's face it, one thing about cannabis is also a lot more valuable than blueberries. So again, nobody ever tries to steal the blueberries. But so there's a lot going on there. I do think there's a place for MSPs to play, right? Like, these guys did not set out to be tech people or business people. there's a mix out there, right? There's the early cannabis growers, or the guys who, they know the plant, they've always wanted to grow cannabis, and now they're allowed, but they weren't really business people, so that's where the money came in. And somewhere in there, the business people are saying, hey, we need the growers to grow us the best plant possible. We could probably collect a lot of IoT data that helps us to make sure that we're growing the best plant possible, but we need people who know the business systems to help us manage it all. And that's where the, as always, that's where the MSP opportunity is.
Note to self, steal blueberries. Apparently it's easy.
A lot easier. Nobody's watching the blueberries that closely.
No one's watching the blueberries. I will have all the blueberries. Okay. There is a lot of opportunity here. For a technology provider and MSP, there are some inherent risks, though, with working with cannabis companies, especially given that it's still technically a federal, a drug that's federally banned or illegal at the federal level. I have to imagine there's some issues with the financial part of working with these kinds of companies. But what are the other there's a lot here to talk about. And I talked a lot about this. Can you kind of give a little sense of like what some of the other opportunities are besides surveillance and what some of the risks are?
From an other opportunities kind of standpoint, I mean, where Lewis, for example, kind of got into the market, the first thing, if I remember right, that he was asked to do was just set up guest Wi-Fi networks at some of the, the retail outlets, which again is the kind of thing that could happen at any retail business, and it kind of, grew from there. So that there's stuff that you can do at the store that you would do more or less for any store. There's the video surveillance, the physical security. There's all of the sort of line, warehouse management, distribution management kind of aspect of the business. From a risk standpoint, you were just kind of saying, this is still a crime at a federal level. Laws are evolving. One of the things that I was interested in when we sort of commissioned, we had a freelancer go out and work on this article, is how do you deal with the fact that, from what I understand, it's difficult for a lot of the companies that play in this space to get a bank account, and to do a lot of the things conventional businesses do. And somewhat to my surprise, according to this article that we have published, that is not the people who play in this space say this is not, that's not as big an issue as you would think. Interestingly enough, though, what a number of them did say was an issue, and which I didn't anticipate, was just that there are some businesses out there who have nothing to do with cannabis who are a little uncomfortable with getting their managed IT services from a company that plays in the cannabis space. And so, there's actually a source that we quote in this article who has a company that focuses 100% on the legalized marijuana space, who is unnamed. Like, we couldn't put his name in the article because he has two businesses, one that's all for the marijuana business, one that's for everybody else. And he was a little worried about getting his name in print to the non-marijuana customers because it might make them a little uncomfortable. Luis Alvarez has two businesses now, one of which is 100% dedicated to his cannabis customers for that reason. So there's this sort of brand management aspect of this, which I hadn't really thought about before, but that is kind of a risk that you can run into.
I have to think that for a dedicated cannabis, I think Cheech and Chong have a big advantage with their brand in that space. Maybe they should start an IT company.
Up and smoke IT.
Up and smoke IT. Right. And Rich, and they also worked out all of the payment problems because now they just pay in blueberries.
That's it. There was my understanding is that because it's a federal issue, then there are state banks and the state banks are okay because the states are okay with it. But I remember there was a story years ago, 2014 or so, right after Colorado legalized, that someone showed up at the state office with bags of cash to pay their taxes at the tax office, like in Denver. And they had no idea how to accept cash. No one had ever come with bags of cash to pay their taxes in cash. So I think it was shortly after that where they figured out, all right, so we want our piece, and I believe it went through state banks. or possibly blueberries.
Blueberries is the currency of the future.
Bags of blueberry. By the way, we keep throwing out the latest business idea. Are you ready? There's no way that this will not be funded. You will get funding instantly. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
A AI machine learning blockchain cannabis farm.
Just drop the mic right there, man. You got it. That's awesome.
It's not 100% original, but I was there when the joke was created, so I think I get to use it.
Fantastic. All right, moving on. There is actually a lot in that article. We're going to put a link to it in the show notes or in the description area on YouTube. If you're go and read that. If you're in the space and you're thinking about some of the opportunities in working with those kinds of businesses, if they're in your state, definitely give that a read. The last article, we've got 10 minutes here, and I think we can fit in one more story. The last one is partnering with unconventional partners. Now, obviously, Rich, I made a joke in the beginning, like, oh, yeah, you want to, you know, partner with bakers. And yeah, I'm joking on. What is this all about?
So the whole concept for Channel Pros of partnering with partners is not a new concept, right? I mean, and that it's actually a big part of Rory's business is he knows security. If you're an MSP who doesn't, but you need to offer good security services to your customers, you can partner with Rory as a partner, and the two of you can go to market together. And, you know, we've written articles over the years about how to do that successfully and deal with the contractual issues and all that kind of stuff. But this partnering with unconventional partners article that we posted really is about thinking beyond IT companies as potential partners. So I don't know if partnering with a baker is necessarily an option, but partnering with the cable guy, partnering with the folks who maintain air conditioners, partnering with cleaning services. There are all these different kinds of businesses that serve SMBs. Really, you're just another kind of business that serves SMBs. You provide technology services. If you can establish relationships with companies that are outside of IT so that you're sending your customers to them and they're sending their customers to you, you can create this kind of symbiotic relationship there where everybody is growing their business faster than they would otherwise. So, there really isn't a whole lot to dive into in this topic here. Really, it's just about getting people to think bigger about who they might potentially partner with as a means of improving what they can offer and finding new customers.
It seems obvious. Maybe it's not obvious. I would think that this is something that most people would have thought of if you're a business owner and your strategies to try and find new business to work with other kind of non-related businesses to you. Rory, do you have partnerships with like the local produce grower and the carpet cleaning company nearby to find business?
Just the blueberry guys.
Only those who sell blueberries.
Only those who sell blueberries. it's not every business makes sense, but if you're in the SMB space, then, you know, there's absolutely something to be said about building that network of other folks who sell into the SMB space. Think about it. There's nothing better than one of your clients asks you for some sort of a referral and you know who to refer, right? Somebody says, hey, you seem to know everybody in town. We're looking for a great place to cater our next event. And you know, a great caterer. So, you know, that does seem like basic maybe knowledge, but I think maybe a lot of the MSPs don't always get out into the community and meet others who are maybe targeting the same type clients. I know I've done some of that here locally in the West Palm Beach area. A good friend of mine who I think I may have introduced to Joel one time, and since then she's been featured in your magazine once or twice, but she's phenomenal at that. She's always involved in some of the local community activities, and I think that's paid off really well. So absolutely, you know, it doesn't always have to be a direct relationship. Some are probably better than others. If you're interested in finding you SMB businesses moving into your community, you know, the real estate broker, somebody selling office furniture, right? Who are they going to call first, right? The, you know, the connectivity folks, right? They're going to know that there's somebody new coming in. New businesses often go to their, you know, we're opening a new office in this town. We're going to contact the local chamber of commerce and ask, hey, who should we get to handle our IT? And who are they going to recommend? They're going to say, here's our book of all the people who are our members. But, you know, circle one and go, those guys support the chamber. Those guys help us around here all the time. So I'd call them, right? You never know where that next referral is going to come from. Also, there's a lot of accounting practices who don't necessarily, you know, they're accountants, right? They're bean counters. They're super careful on how much money they spend. So they don't always like the MSP recurring revenue model. But a lot of accounting firms have launched consultancies, and then they are trying to provide some additional services to their clients. And that's a opportunity for MSPs to partner with them and offer IT services to accounting firm clients. The accounting firm often becomes a trusted advisor, right? Their clients are calling them and going, hey, I love what you're doing for me. Thanks for saving me money on taxes. Who should handle my IT? And that's how a lot of these firms launch consultancies. So there's some partnership opportunities there, right? We could probably talk about that all afternoon, but
right, absolutely.
Do people really listen to you guys for 2 hours? Is anybody still tuned into this?
You'd be surprised, actually. You really would be. Yeah, well, Sina, we do need to wrap up, but that was some great insight there, and we'll put a link to this story. And, of course, all of the stories that we talked about here today, we will put a link to all of them from the show notes page. So go to channelpronetwork.com, find the show sheet for episode 124, and then you'll find all the links there. Same thing if you're watching on YouTube. We kind of put a little screen caps of the articles up as we go, but you can read the full text of all of these stories. Go to the description area, and you'll find all the links there to go and check those out. If you like Channel Pro Weekly and you want to subscribe, that's the way to do it, Rory. If you didn't know, you can subscribe to Channel Pro Weekly. We are on iTunes, we're on Google Play Podcasts, we're on Stitcher, we're pretty much anywhere podcasts are aggregated. Go to our show sheet, find one of those services, and subscribe. Then poof, new episodes come down all the time. If you like watching on YouTube, you can subscribe to us there. Hit that subscribe button and also the bell, because the subscribe button doesn't really do anything but give you the ability to hit the bell. The bell tells you when we have new shows. You'll absolutely want to hit that and follow along there. Make Channel Pro Network your homepage. Every time you're on the computer, there's always new stories coming up all the time, all day, every day. News, insights, white papers, documentation, videos, anything and everything you can think of to help you with your business. ChannelProNetwork.com is the website. Make sure you bookmark that. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we are at ChannelProSMB. If you want to follow us on Facebook, we're Channel Pro Network on Facebook. Get involved with us there. If you want to follow me, I'm Matt Whitlock. Rich, you are?
At Rich Free.
And Mr. Rory, of course, I would like to give you a warm thank you for joining us this week. For people who want to learn a little bit more about you and your business, where can they go?
TrueDigitalSecurity.com.
And are you on the Facebooks and the Twitters?
Oh, absolutely. Are we on Twitter? I don't know if we're on Twitter. We're definitely on Facebook and LinkedIn.
All right. So go to LinkedIn and go to Facebook and possibly Twitter. I'm sure it's all there. TrueDigitalSecurity.com is his website. Go in follow them and learn about what they have to offer. Rich, I think that's going to wrap up episode 124. There will be no Museum Picker Tech Bit this week because we're kind of running up against the clock. So we will be back with that. Rory, we didn't get a chance to play five questions with Rory Sanchez, but we will absolutely do that the next time you're on.
The next time I run into Rich somewhere, then I'll see you just after that.
Always bump into Rich and boom, you're on the show. That's how it works. But five questions is a lot of fun. We've done that with a few others, and we'll keep doing that going forward. So yeah, that's going to wrap up episode 124. Thank you very much, Rory Sanchez, True Digital Security, our guest host. Thank you for being here. Mr. Rich Freeman, of course, my partner in crime and co-host. Thank you for your time. And thank you, our listening and viewing audience, for making time to check out Jelper Weekly. Make sure you share it with your coworkers, colleagues, friends, family, any pets, anybody who likes IT and a good laugh, and blueberries, apparently. If you like blueberries, this is the show.
This is the show.
This is the show for you. So thank you all again. We'll see you all next week.